So welcome back to LA Lit with Eileen Miles. I think that we were going to start off with a prose reading.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If you want to say anything about that.
I do. What will I say? It's an excerpt from a novel. And this, had I read this here before? Was it familiar to you?
No, I don't think you read this at the late night snack thing.
Right, no.
You read something about the house you were staying in, the artist's house.
Yeah, good, okay, great. Yeah. Good, I wanted to check. Yeah. No, this is an excerpt from a novel, and the novel is called The Inferno, a Poet's Novel, and I've been writing it. I'm kind of done with it, though I saw a little excerpt of it the other day that I felt really confident about, and when I looked at it, I thought, oh my God, it's not. I thought it was all perfect and done, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, I guess a book isn't really done until it's in print, you know. But anyway, it's very much about being a poet, and it follows Dante's Inferno. So the first 100 pages is about a female poet, a woman coming to New York. I mean, the character's name is Eileen Miles. A woman, she goes to New York to be a poet, but there's a second narrative going on where is she going to become a poet or is she going to become a prostitute? You know, so that's the first 100 pages, and that's the Inferno. The hell of being a female poet. And then the next 100 pages is about how to write a poem, and that's heaven, related to Dante's Paradiso. And so it's kind of like how to write a poem, but it's also how to become a lesbian. So it's got they all have baits and switches in them. And the third part is purgatory, and it's called Drops, which relates to, actually there's a kind of, the apples that don't get picked, that just fall off trees in rural areas, get called drops, you know, which kind of intrigued me. And it sort of relates to, in some tangential way, to being a poet, is in the sense that one just finds oneself a poet. You know, you just kind of fall off the tree. You don't, you know, get grown to be a poet. But the purgatory section of the book is about the career of the poet, and so it takes the form of a grant application. And so basically she's just like asking, it's like a Guggenheim application that's been translated into the Ferdinand Foundation. So she's writing, because then when you do a Guggenheim application, there's always the section that's called the career narrative. And so this is, you know, like 100 pages where she actually tells what her career was, has been as a poet. So, I'm wrong. In fact, this is not that. This is the end of heaven. And so in heaven, she's told, the narrator has told in the story everything she knows about being a lesbian and a poet, and then suddenly she thinks, oh, this whole bunch. So it's a really speedy, like everything else that's important, and it's called moving. But it's actually the most information in the whole section of the book. Would you wear this? She held a t-shirt out to me, pale pink with Jenny Holzer truisms rolling down its chest. Abuse of power should come as no disguise, sleeves gone. No. By 1990, everyone was dying. I had a big car, a long, ugly LTD, somebody painted with house paint. Eleanor gave her to me. I couldn't really drive. I drove Tom to the beach in it, and I scared him on those big metal things in Brooklyn. I guess ramps? I had just gotten the dog. I was thinking we would move to San Francisco. The car starts breaking down. I couldn't afford to fix it. The dog was too young. So I left the car in the street and stayed home. Eleanor never forgave me. She walked past it every day till the city took it. She loved that car. Sydney asked me to write a score for her. You mean like music? I asked. No, poems, she smiled. Poems for you to dance to. I wrote some stuff and gave it to her. I stayed for this. I got myself a yellow bow tie and sat in the audience, almost like I was a composer, but I was one of those guys who wrote lyrics, the book. I met a girl, Vivian. Apparently, she told Sarah she had been dreaming of me after seeing me in Orlin, getting up from a table and adjusting my knees. That's how she described it, like I was this old machine. My legs were leather. In a matter of months, we got together, and then all the death began. First Tim, then on and on and on. My sadness was a bell, and she was in there with me, though I'm not sure she knew it. She was a dark-haired girl, sweet, not easy, but smart, and she wrote poems, too. It was extremely bottomy sex for me, because I was a lazy asshole, and she was a complete power-monger, which was fun. The place I found was carved out of sadness and sex, and to write a poem there, you merely needed to gather. There would be days in which feelings were so externalized that you behaved like a painter kid. a painter, a kid with deep pockets, bringing the lavender home. The poem was a grid that swayed, and moving through it, you just picked up things and hung them on the grid, all the while singing your broken heart out, humming. It was a deep, deep gray. In that place, and poetry most of all, is a mastery of places, not the world, but the weather of the states that form in your life, and what you read there, and how things were taken, and what came back. Each of these series of occurrences creates a season. The seasons grow huge till they die, and in each you create a new sense of what a poem is in relation to the space of your mind, heart, that kind of substance. It's the bob of the world you are in. In my courtship or early love with this girl, this is when it really ended, I went to India, and I kept reading and thinking about India after the trip. I finally understood I was Western. I had been thinking at the bottom of reality, everything was that, deep down, that the world was Catholic and even white. And it wasn't. Suddenly, I didn't have a tool. I was a baby. I came back and began researching this thing, certainly wondering about Hinduism as part of the thought, because one day, walking in a temple, all I felt was bad. I didn't have permission to be in there at all. I was overwhelmed to find that child in me, a frightened little Catholic. Seemed to me this couldn't go away, but I needed to move it around. I learned that a bhakti yogi enters a room full of people and methodically moves this thing up and down by telling stories and getting everyone to speak in unison and chant and sing. It's like an invisible barometer he's affecting, the quality of people's togetherness in the room. That's the bhav. I felt now that was my job, to move it. I'm also saying that a life has a bhav, a day has one. A poem is charting that, perhaps giving the sweetest documentation of what anything is ever becoming. So a book of poems, for instance, over a short period of time, a year or two, explains the bhav of that period, and the poet approaches the explanation through form. She invents one that is most economically true to how reality occurred to her at that time. So I came to understand that now I was explaining the world to a sad child, which was me. And I would find her things and try and make a story for her out of what I picked up. I think I was starting to understand a poem as an allegory, a mysterious formula. And I was getting good at realizing the things I picked up, mostly because I was very invested in making them sound good, not too false. Not trapping the poem in oppressive order, but keeping the rhythm fairly close. It always needed to be able to turn around, to step out, to stop. The American language, if you ever noticed, is entirely violent, so you can't go writing these pretty poems that lull and are devoid of the upsetting truths of the world. My poem would often simply stop. When I didn't leave the city, I stayed here and made piles of things out of the sounds of basketballs thunking, elements of war, one in Iraq was happening. I flew right over that on my way to India. Tiny leaves falling on octagonal bricks on the sidewalks of Avenue A. And I remember Bob Perelman saying something about how we had to have gods that we told stories about, and that notion hopped right into one. It was very complete. The world was coughing information up in record time. I used all of it. The sweep of upstate New York, where the girl went to school. The buildings and lawns and fruit stands. My experiment was emptying out now. And I wrote it to the end. She even went to Russia with me at the end of our thing, and she was leaving first, so she demanded I write a poem before she left, and I did. And then we broke up. It hadn't ended totally, of course. It ended so badly that it didn't stop. It disrupted my entire order. It ended the meaning of things. I just always thought that the world was list, and now my list was broken. I was dead. I remember a world going all cubist one morning when I was barely awake. I had sublet my apartment and I came back early. I was moving from place to place, which was nice. It extended the trip. One morning the pieces just fit differently, like something happened to my head. Rather than being sad, I had an ache. I bled. Myra gave me a book called The Passion of Rumi. It told a story about him as a moderate college professor in Turkey with a family, and some dirty saint came to seduce him and drag him into the presence of love and passion. He ruined Rumi's life, and some friends of his actually went and killed the guy, but it was too late. Rumi wasn't Rumi anymore. He probably changed his name. We don't even know who the man he was is. This made sense to me, to completely and utterly submit to the complete passion of the loss, not even of the girl who was small and pretty wrecked herself, but whatever I had been building, whatever I had known myself to be, and however I felt myself known in the eyes of the world, that person was done. It was hard not to die now, to take the easy way out and be actually dead, But I instead saw it was time to stop counting, to stop regarding the world as a list, and to consider existence in writing a poem as a matter of devotion, an expression of desire. It probably sounds like I had already been there, but for one thing, I had been drunk then, many years before, when I came out all over Rose, and I only understood desire with my mind. Now I went on a little rampage in the world, standing at a party with a drink and stealthily moving the conversation over to sex. And if she saw red, it was red, and we immediately went out and had sex. I had no idea this was possible, that women were just as easy as men. I mean, I had known it over time, but never all at once. I realized I just had to establish a common ground and we could go have sex there. This wasn't entirely passion, but it was sex, and I needed to be incredibly dirty and abandoned as possible in order to stay alive. This piece of passion that I held, a pounding in my body, was my slim candle, my connection to the world. I don't recall writing any poems then. The whole thing backfired in about a year, feeling something a little like love with one of these people, a friend, and I pulled back to my corner and I loved to think. I saw Tony Fair one day on Avenue A, and I told him my problem, which had now become that I obviously needed to desire one woman, and I was feeling some desire for someone, and I said, what should I do? And he said, proclaim it. He told me about a very beautiful friend of ours, Phil, and how he had once told him exactly what he would like to do to him. He was so gorgeous. Phil laughed. He said, Tony, that's sweet. Tony explained to me that I didn't have to get the person. What you needed to do was to announce your feelings. That was the truth. Okay, so I tried it on this woman during a walk in the park. She said, that's sweet. I swear that's what she said. I had just found a small baby sock on the ground at the entrance to the park. It was a small red sock with Winnie the Pooh on its side. The sock was still in the shape of the baby foot. I extended it to her. It was warm. In fact, she felt it. She told me that. I actually went to a convention soon after, and I saw this same woman in the hotel lobby, and she was doing this thing that Anne Waldman also does, which is to bang her hip against mine while she talks. Is this a kind of magnetism? Am I in my body or not? The woman said she was staying in this hotel, the one we were standing in. I told her I was staying with my friends. She looked at me for a moment, and then she wandered off into the crowd. Oh, God, did she mean? I started looking for her, but it was too late. I felt sick. There was also another woman I was dating at this time, and I wanted to announce my passion to her as well. But she kept standing me up. Finally, I sent her a postcard with a dolphin leaping through a flaming hoop on its front. When you wiggled the postcard, the dolphin leapt through. I felt that that said it all, and I had just quit jumping for her. Now what? It was Gay Pride weekend, and I had marched down Fifth Avenue with Anne and Heather, and we were all looking for something to do, so we wound up sitting in Mogador watching the people go by. A writer named Gabrielle Glancy came by and sat down. She always had very interesting hair, dark and poofy like an empress. She showed us a flyer she had about a lesbian sex auction celebrating Gay Pride. Would we like to go? We would. It took us a while to decide, but eventually the four of us were walking across town. It was in the vault, or one of those places, Paddles. A black box with a stage where women were chained and writhing, and the club was a profusion of pens, mangers, really, where women in various positions and combinations were engaged in their pleasure. I was kind of disappointed. It seemed like there were legal limits to what you could do, like there wasn't even any fucking. Hard to believe, but it's true. On a table, a long table, there was this beautiful girl with long curly hair lying on her stomach, and her top, someone short and short-haired for sure, was massaging the beautiful girl's asshole with a vibrator and slowly inserted a butt plug with a horsetail sprouting from it. We were all gathered around. The girl was writhing and digging it, and as far as I was concerned, this was the show. People were getting auctioned up on stage, but I didn't see anything that I wanted, nor did I think I should be for sale. Over in that corner, there were a bunch of people playing with fire. Heather was drawn to that, and soon she had her shirt off, and she had a look of extreme release, and soon her back was on fire. Anne was very excited by this, and they were gone, and I continued to follow the expressions of the girl with the tail, or wandering around, mainly almost ready to go home. The three of us did leave together, and Anne and Heather seemed they had now joined forces, and we all went to one final club with stuff going on downstairs. Cave Canem was what it was. I saw the woman from the convention was there with her girlfriend. We told them all about the lesbian sex auction. Somebody we knew was up on stage with clothespins all over her naked body. We didn't say who. Anne greedily described Heather's flaming body. Heather was cool, even opening her shirt a bit on the back so we could see. "And what did you do?" the woman said, turning to me. "Just stand there?" At McDowell, I saw a woman who looked much like my last girlfriend, but this time her hair was white. I cringed. It was like a negative of Vivian. It was like a film idea. But within days, I had come to the conclusion that whatever the outcome, I would make my desire for her abundantly clear, and I would unleash every excess of power in my body and soul and mind to convince her that my aim was true, and then I would have her. Not forever, just for now. I wanted her in a roomy way. It was the desire at the center of the universe. This was the beginning of the love for which I had not died. I was climbing over the ramparts of my own death. It was the life. I didn't need to marry her was the problem, but that was much later. If passion was a substance, I would say it is dark brown and then blood red. It's like wet grass, tons of it soaked in mud. It's warm and it stinks like shit, and it's unaccountably and endlessly good. It's thick and it goes on for miles, and it isn't so much deep as bottomless, and it holds you in its grip. You never drown. And then it goes. That's all you know. I began to assemble my love in words, poems, and I was an idiot tramping through the woods as I did one night when I fled a casual three or a four-way with her and some other colonists. I wanted her too badly to share. The feeling of these new poems wasn't anything like the sad fog of the past. It was bright white, and it had the power of memory, and I cut scenes like a filmmaker so that in one I saw a character much like myself pacing in a winter room, and I spoke to that adult now and was making something new, a new three-part space in memory of that bright room in which I swore to open myself wholly to where I stood with her within that ideal space of possibility. I invited her into my studio one day, not to seduce her, but to let her smell it, the space, like an animal, and see that it was safe. I knew in my heart that if she stood there for a moment, later on she would be mine, and she was. What I started to understand was that the poem was made out of time, past, present, and future. It lives in the present. It breathes there, and that's how you let anyone in. I think people can feel this accessing of time in poetry very readily. And as soon as the poem ceases to be about anything, when it stops even saving things, stops being such a damn collector, it becomes an invite to the only refuge, which is the impossible moment of being alive. I lost her after a while, and of course she was never mine. I borrowed her, and she borrowed me from our lives. Yet in the middle of that, it was a stark white moment of sensational love, and then she returned to her girlfriend, and I to New York, and I told anyone who would listen the story of the incredible love, which probably should be a book of its own one day, and while I was waiting for her, maybe to fade, knowing I needed to let her go, I went down to Cape Cod for a weekend to teach. It was remarkable. That October, the skies were purple and brown, most of the houses were empty, and sat on tight hills tumbling down to the ocean. There was a zendo in Truro. I got there late, so they wouldn't let me in, but I came back. I loved it all so much. I was at a party in a gallery, and I heard about a house I could rent, so I walked up its back stairs in the pouring rain, and the ocean was right there, and I wrote a check. In a few months, I was living there with my dog. I was writing a book. Because, of course, I hadn't done much work in the summer when I met the girl. But I was in this new place, and I was working now. In the middle of the day, I went for a walk. I loved the winter town, Provincetown, with all the flashy stores closed. This was the right end of the bargain for me. Cold, and I even saw a woman with a black eye patch coming out of a convenience store the first night, and I knew her instantly from a story I had been told almost 20 years before. She had been very close to a man, Paul Johnson, who I knew in Boston, Eva Nelson's class. He was a lot like René Ricard. Do we meet the same people again and again? Paul was a queer who had my number. He offered me a couple of things I was barely ready to know, but in centaur tradition of generous men, he taught me. Paul was dead, and his picture was there on her refrigerator. She had this little red fisherman's house, and Paul and she had worked together fishing scallops, which is how I knew she had her accident, which he told me about that morning in New York, and he was also close to her kid. Paul died when everyone died of AIDS. I had learned about it in Ann Golden's video at the Whitney. Somebody just casually said it, walking down Commercial. Now everyone's dead. Paul Johnson. I felt like I was here to visit him. I had seen him so long ago in Cambridge. He was driving a cab. He told me about P-Town, and he just looked manly and large, like that was pleasant for him. It seemed like he was just working. Isn't that throwing your life away, I thought? But in fact, he was fishing and having sex, and then he left P-Town for law school and fought for tenants' rights. In college, he was a skinny fag. In college, he was bi. I was standing in the middle of the winter town one afternoon, and the sky was blue, and the air was incredibly white and clear, and there were boats in the water, and it was sparkling, everything. The day was clear, glass. I whipped out my notebook, stuck the cap of my pen on its back. I was ready to gather this and that. It would not be the whole text of this day, it would only be fragments. But I didn't begin. It had lately been a problem in poems that poems didn't make money, you couldn't sell them. So what were they worth? Everyone assigned them this grand art value, everybody that cared at all. I wanted to be famous. Now I thought I would probably get famous and rich from fiction. So why was poetry still good? What was it worth? When I was younger, I watched it become money, and that saved me. It became my work. Now I was just standing in the day. Had I ever considered what this was worth, just standing in the goods? If the words I plucked out of standing here were incomplete, then probably they were not it. And maybe this was, the thing was existence itself. Rumi had somebody following him around all day long while he spoke the poem. He was simply in it. I was in it too. The room was the poem, the day I was in. Oh, Christ. What writes my poem is the second ring, inner or outer. Poetry is just the performance of it. These little things, whether I write them or not, that's the score. The thing of great value is you, where you are, glowing and fading while you live. Did I get out of it now? Am I done? Tom and I used to always go to parties together in the 70s. We even lived together for a while in my apartment. And once in my absence, he stretched out all my clothes, my gray beret, doing me. He said he was doing Eileen drag. Tom was a cute blonde and a great friend to have when you're young. He's also pretty good old. We had an agreement then to always go to parties together, both being queer and lonely and usually impossibly in love. He loved Elio for a very long time. I loved Rose. So we were kind of companions, consummate dates. He came from an acting family and seemed much more comfortable than me in the world. When Tom arrived at a party, he had this booming voice. He greeted everyone by name, ticked them off so they all knew that they were there. He made people happy when he arrived. Tom's here, they'd go, and he knew you too. However, there was always a point in the night when he'd say, "I've got to go, I." "Why, Tom?" He would look at me seriously. "Are you coming?" "Well, yes, no, I mean." Over the years, I discovered it was always good to go. I have a hard time knowing what to do about leaving. I'd feel I was ready, and yet I was too embarrassed to draw attention to myself by saying goodbye, so I'd wait or leave with Tom or someone. Sometimes I'd just escape, not saying a word. I tried to get over it, but it never got any better. I think a poem is like a party, because it has to end. You've got to leave eventually. Tom knew. I asked him why he left so abruptly. "I'll tell you, I," he said, being manly, miming his father. "No, I guess it's him. When I walk into a room, I take a deep breath, and when that breath is gone, I have to go. There's nothing left." Thing is, when you're writing a poem, no matter what you meant to say or do, when the leaving impulse comes, just finish your line and get the hell out of the room. Though sometimes, even if you said too much, you can still go back and fix it. You can actually learn to have grace, and that's heaven.
So, what, when you're writing prose, I mean, It's necessarily a poet writing prose, right? And I wonder how it is for you, like when you're writing, like, say, Chelsea Girls or Cool for You, are you still a poet? I mean, I know that's kind of a ridiculous question, but
yeah, you're kind of. I mean, it's almost like saying, are you still a poet when you're at work?
Yeah, sure.
It's like really, I mean, truly, you're like in a different structure, being a poet in there. So you know all this stuff that maybe other people writing novels don't know,
yeah.
You know, and you get to do that, but you still sort of have to do it. Often when other people, when other poets say they've written a poet novel, I'm kind of like groan. I think it's going to be like impossible to read and really hard and, you know, and But I mean, I want some of that, but I want it to have some of the novel thing too, because the novel is kind of a manipulation. I mean, I think the novel, as I understand it, is something that people want to read, and they like to buy novels, and they just want a good read, you know. So this like, I want there to be some of the novel thing that makes you keep turning the pages and stuff. Like Leslie Scalapino famously published a really big fat book of poetry, and it had like a triple title. It was like Orion, the Pearl, and the End of Painting, a novel. And it looked like poetry, you know? So I said, well, why did you call it a novel? And she said, well, if you call it a novel, people just read from the front page to the back, you know? And so I was like, oh, it's like a way of reading. But like more than conceptually, I sort of think that I wanted to give that in some way, you know?
Well, I have one of these kind of questions that's like an interview show kind of question, and that's what are some things that you haven't done yet in your life that you want to do?
Oh.
If it's okay. If not, I have another question.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's like, I suppose it changes all the time. I guess I want to make a film. I want to make a film. I want to go to Turkey. I'd like to be fluent in another language. I do think about flying a plane, but it's probably the worst idea I ever had. But I did fly a plane for about, I mean, like, I didn't really fly. I was like in one of those teeny, teeny, teeny planes, and it was like, it had a second steering wheel, and the guy who was flying said, you want to try? And I was like, I was terrified at the question, but I said, okay, and I just went like that, and the plane went like that, and then I went, you know, it was an incredible feeling, you know, and the smaller the plane is, the more exciting it gets. And so that is very exciting to me, and I think about it, but I mean, it's probably, I mean, like, I'm a little bit of a spaced out person. Like, people are actually, some friends are actually afraid to drive with me. So I sort of think I have to keep this idea to myself, because if I told anybody who knew me well, they would be really terrified, and they would never fly with me. But then sometimes it's like the problem is you're in the wrong language. Like, it might be that I'm really a pilot, not a car driver. And it would make more sense it behind the wheel of a plane. So who knows? You know? So those are some things.
Well, so I think we're going to open up questions to the audience. So if anybody has a question.
You're on the spot now, more or less.
It's your turn.
But we can be Buddhist about it and just be quiet.
Well, I have a question. You kind of touched on this a little before, but I was just wondering, myself, having lived in New York a long time.
What's your name?
Doug.
Hi.
And come out here a lot, and now I'm spending more time out here, mostly out here. But I was just wondering about when you came out to the West from New York, were you worried at all about losing that stimulation of New York, the, you know, so much about the rhythm of the day and this constant assault on the senses? And also, one thing that I really noticed between the East Coast and the West Coast, especially even in San Francisco and New York, people tell stories all the time about their day. And often I've been at gatherings on the West Coast where I noticed this more actually in San Francisco than Los Angeles, but when you tell stories about your day, sometimes people are looking at you like, why is he telling us this? You know,
right.
Like, you're just saying, well, I was at the bus stop, and there was this dog with a bandage, and they're like, you know, and people will say things like, oh, I hate to see animals hurting, you know, and I'm like, well, that's not really the point of the story, but I was just wondering.
That's so great.
But I was just wondering if you had that anxiety about coming out here, and I don't know the circumstances of you coming out, but
yeah.
But would you be worried about losing that? Inspiration.
God, the last thing you said, though, is so great that I feel like I've noticed that on some level, but never the conscious one. And I think it's really true that it's like, there's often the sense that you're just too heavy or you're talking too much or something, and people can't figure out why, what need is being, and it's just like, everybody in New York does it to them. I mean, like, it's even, I mean, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's I think it's really true. I don't know, I think I might, I think I did have fears, but I was really in denial about it. Like, I kept my apartment, you know? And so I, when I moved to San Diego, I just went back a lot, You know, I mean, I would do two things. Once I would make, you know, like several months, I would like not go back to New York. It was always like, I'm not going back to New York. And I have a few months so I could kind of be on the West Coast and stuff. And then once I let go of that, all hell broke loose and I started going to New York like twice a month and stuff. And then it just got really messy because I would be like, every place I was, people would be, especially in New York, people would say, are you here? You know, so there was this horrible feeling that I was never anywhere. So I guess, I think I was probably very worried, but I didn't want to admit it. I was very like, nothing's gonna change. I just have this job and I'm really in New York still. And you know, but the thing that I actually noticed the most was at some point, because I started to feel that, I think I started to get depressed because I wasn't talking to as many people. And I wasn't, the thing I literally felt, I was driving my car one day on the freeway and I thought, I'm just not getting enough face. You know, and I just realized that in New York I was really used to looking at people's faces all the time and talking to faces, and that I wasn't having that so much in California. I was on the freeway and I was in my house and sometimes I was teaching and I was, you know, with these four people at dinner, but it always seemed like the space was very controlled and laid out and it wasn't this constant, and there was actually that I in some ways I didn't know how to be human, you know, because I thought I stopped picking up the phone because I realized a lot of my phone use was about arranging immediate, you know, I'll see you, you know, like that, and it wasn't about that, and I just didn't, it took me a long time, actually it wasn't until I broke up with my girlfriend, who seemed to be doing just fine with the phone thing, because she would just have long conversations with her friends on the East Coast on the phone, and for some reason I couldn't get into that rhythm, and so I just wasn't picking up the phone at all, and I was just getting very strange. And I think I started to realize how I had to be different, and I had to socialize different to be in California. Like I had to reach out, I had to call people, I had to make plans. You know, whereas in New York, I just felt like I'd just go out and my month would be planned. And I would make 1,000 dates and I would break them all the time and nobody minded, and people in California would be hurt if you broke a date. I was like, what? You know, it's just like I thought date, you were like, sure, I'll see you Friday. And it was like, you won't be there, but so what? We're both too busy. And it was just, it's a very different rhythm to socializing. And yes, I have fear.
Any more questions you may have?
Well, I have one other question. Okay. When you write, are you ever conscious of the fact that since you do, obviously, you're very conscious of the performance aspect of your work, and you read in that way. Are you ever, when you're writing these poems, is there any tension between thinking about writing it and hearing it to be performed, or writing it and thinking of it as this is something that someone will read on the page? You know what I mean? Is there any problem with that? Or is there any worry? You're worried about the influence of writing to be performative versus the page?
Yeah. You know, no, because I think I kind of, I think I've been doing it for so long that I think I anticipate both in different ways. And so it seems, I mean, I think on some level, even as I'm writing, I feel like I'm hitting one base and then the other in some way. Like some parts of writing seem more, I mean, the moment seems like written as I'm writing, and some moments I can really imagine saying it or it being heard, you know. And also I think, you know, I'm not sure everybody who writes feels this way, but I really experience writing as a form of listening. You know, it's sort of like, it's like some part of me telling me what, you know, like there's an interpreting part that's addressing. You know, and so the performance is implicit in the experience of writing for me in many ways. You know, I mean, like, you know, years ago I used to more literally perform, which I would memorize the text, and that was interesting because I could really, not every poem was interesting, worth memorizing. You know what I mean? Like it was, some really, really lent themselves to that treatment and others didn't, you know, and I'm not sure that same distinction exists anymore, you know, and also I realized it was like, because it was a whole period where I, you know, I started, before I got published, I started doing readings, you know, and that just seemed like it was something to do in the 70s, and it was how I entered the poetry scene. So it was definitely part of how I learned to, just part of my learning experience to read. You know, so you know, it's sort of like, so if you really, if you start reading almost immediately as you start writing, you just instantly kind of have a body language that you do when you read. And the thing that was weird about performing was that I didn't have a body language. And then I started to be in the hands of people who were actors and performers who would say, well, why don't you move here? And they would start giving me, and it felt so queer. You know, it just felt really weird and fake, you know, and I did that for a while. And after a while, I just realized that actually reading was more performative for me than reciting, because I had really become accustomed to the relationship between my body and the text and reading, and that I actually performed more when I read than I would when I had to look at people, you know? And then realizing too that even people felt uncomfortable or differently comfortable. Like people who came to hear a poetry reading, when the poet was looking at them, they'd be freaked out. They'd just be like, why is Eileen looking at us, you know? And you would just see people that you knew just kind of cringing. You know, and you know, so it was very strange, but it was really kind of great to realize that the performance, and then you know, it's very kind of almost coy that if you have a career where, I mean, because you can really see, you watch academics, and they read papers, and they're just like little stone soldiers, they're like, dar, 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 you know, and stuff, and partially, you know, they're really truly uncomfortable, but there also is that kind of puritanical thing where they're not. Because I know they are the same people. Like, if they were talking, they would be using their bodies. They would be. And probably when they teach, they use their bodies. But when they read, they don't. And I think there's a sense that there's something low and base about illustrating. You know, I mean, like, you're talking about this experience here, but you're not, because you're a writer, you're not supposed to actually use your hands, because that's pretending that you're speaking. But you are speaking. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like, it took me a long time of reading to realize that it was really okay to use actual body language illustrating the text, because if I was talking, I would, you know? And so there's no reason to be shy about using my body. You know, so it's there's been layers and layers of performance and learning and basically giving myself permission. Like, silence is the greatest permission I've given myself. It took me years of reading to realize that that I know that there are silences in the piece, but it's like, am I entitled to take them in front of an audience? You know, like, it's sort of like, can you really, like, let that be, like, admit that you believe this is music and that you have permission to use it, treat it that way? And that was really a big freedom, you know? And it used to be, too, in the poetry, well, every world's like this. There's the poetry world, the performance art world. I mean, there's less of a performance art world. Like, every decade had, like, a world, right? I mean, like, in terms of what's fashionable and stuff, like, architecture's hot now, right? You know, it was like something else 10 years ago, but it's like, all these worlds have their own rules. And one of the things that I find sort of problematic is that certainly when there was such a thing as a performance poet or performance art, if you performed your work a little too much, people would start withholding support or identification with you. They would say, well, she's really a performer. You know, and it was just like, there was kind of a put down, like you weren't really literary. You know, and there was sort of a threat that if you did too much of this, you would lose your status over here. And I mean, it's still to a certain extent true, and I think perhaps they just care less, but it's very weird how I think we tend to do that in the art and literary world, to kind of, maybe because the pies, you know, it's sort of like the pies of money, or I don't know, but it's weird. And it seems like it always makes it less rich and less interesting. And,
I think Teresa has a question.
I don't know exactly how to ask this, but I was thinking about when you were talking previously about American English and how so much is said in the way that it's said.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of language as a barrier between, like a kind of padding. And then also in the novel where you talk about the yogi who walks in the room and he's able to command the mm-hmm. sort of energy. And I wanted, which is similar in this way, it's like, and I wanted to talk about connotation in your work, and is there something about that, like, you know?
Well, what do you mean when you say connotation? I mean, I know what the word means, but what do you mean?
I mean, do you think about, like, what is it? I guess it's like the thing, what's being, the relationship between the said and the unsaid, and the kind of manipulation of energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's different with, you know, it's different in any piece of writing,
mm-hmm.
right? Because some pieces of writing really use that.
Right, but
a lot.
But I think a lot of times, I mean, is there that you can actually begin to develop a practice for how that is felt, right?
Right.
And so I was just wondering if you could talk more about that.
Oh God, I don't. I mean, it still seems. It's like I want you to talk more or something to tell me more what you know. Because I'm thinking writing is all about what was said and what's unsaid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems to me that that's part of what's fun about it,
mm-hmm.
is that you have this one thing going, and then
are there particular things that you find that you're unsaying over and over again?
That
you're not saying or unsaying?
No, I mean, I would think that would, I mean, like, sure, I mean, probably, you know, personally, you know, maybe that, but, and that would be interesting if I told you what they were or something, but I know you're not trying to get me to divulge, right?
No.
But I think there probably are some personal issues that I'm always, and things that, and also, you know, perhaps things that, I think we all have stories that really rule our lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, there are certain little narratives that it's like, oh, that's her, you know, like, when you, my mother has a series of stories, you know, it's sort of weird, right? She just told all those same stories over and over again, you know? And
right.
And I know I've had the experience with memory where when I've written about something, what's sort of a problem is that what the version you wrote becomes the entire memory,
mm-hmm.
and covers all other versions. And, you know, I mean, I've had particularly this problem with, like, friends who are like, you know, older friends who are writers who I knew as a younger person, and now those people, you know, people interview me and want to know about that person, and if I've written about them, then it's really bad because I don't know anything more now. I just only know what I wrote. You know, it's just sort of like, and I realize that sort of inevitably, I'm just like my mother. I'm just stuck with my stories, you know. And so there's a way in which I have stories that, like, I'm just always ready to go back and tell again, you know. And so I have a fear that, you know, some certain stories I just, you know, my father's death, I'm compelled to tell and tell and tell and tell and tell, and I've given myself complete permission because I think, well, that's just my story, and that's always going to be my story, and it's going to come up a million times. But there are other stories, you know, like, I'm wary of retelling, and so I'm kind of, like, I can feel them coming, and then I start to suppress them, and it seems like part of what I work with.
Mm-hmm.
But I still don't think that's quite what you were.
That's maybe close enough for now.
When I started to answer, I think I had more of a sense of what I was responding to than I do by now. is it Catherine? What was your name?
Yeah, Catherine.
Toby, she came here through a kind of, was she works in the animal field, is a vet, and so she came here through an interesting number of
work connection.
Yeah, but when we were talking at the break, she was talking about animals and people and how animals, you read them through their gestures and you know what an animal, and yet people also, we also, you know, and you also can read people, but people are often saying something else. And then the gestures, and what do we do? I mean, I feel like that's very much about that. Like, I thought, and I think that there's that I think we do when we're writing all the time, is we're telling a story, and then you're, I mean, it's, and you see it in film, too. Like, it's sort of like, I don't know why Goodfellas was always an astonishing film for me for that, because it was the narration and the action were just a little bit off, and it was fascinating how they never quite caught up, and they would be running neck and neck, and it was fascinating to feel that tension. But I think that in writing, you're always manipulating that tension of what you're showing and what you're telling, or what somebody's saying and how they're moving, and to. But you were gonna.
Yeah, I was also really intrigued by what you said about English, and I was gonna ask if you spoke any other languages enough to write in them, or if there are any that you wish that you could.
No, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I studied German in college, So I have kind of a thing for German, and I've been on it too hard. And when I've been in Germany, I think maybe as I get older, I feel less shamed or more when I've been in France or Germany languages that I have some tiny access to, or even Mexico, I feel like I'm better at speaking and listening than ever before, not because I have more vocabulary. I think I almost have less, but I care less. But I've not. I don't. I have little bits of language. Do you?
No. I've always wished that I could, put on another language for a while and see what it felt like.
I know. Yeah. I got a little ways in Russia. I was there that long. I was there for like 10 weeks. Yeah, the plan was to be there for 6 months, and so I was taking lessons in somebody's house. But I was just having such a nervous breakdown in the culture that it was like, even as I was learning the language, I was like falling apart personally, But it was interesting because I started to fall apart in Russian, And just before I left Russia, I had this weird experience. I was on the subway, and this couple were having a fight, and suddenly I knew what they were saying. And it was scary. It was like that silent thing was over, in that sense that you were all alone in your little, it was like it was violating. Kind of to know what they were talking about, but it was that sad thing where like the thing was breaking. It was breaking just as I was leaving,
I was falling apart in Russian, different from falling apart in English.
Well, I think part of the reason I was falling apart was that I wasn't in English, and I realized that so much of my way of being in the world and protecting myself and building myself up and valuing myself was through my use of language, and suddenly it's just be this little face that said da. It was just so pathetic and sad. I just felt really castrated, and infantile. I mean, it was all so many bad feelings, And also then you were just in another culture being read without your power. So I became this kind of older, sort of masculine woman that people didn't, it was like you really became, and then you were in Russia, so they just did, there was so many slots that I didn't fit into. And it was really painful, and I couldn't disabuse people of those notions, and it just was creating a complete nervous breakdown.
Well, I think we should probably wrap it up. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.